I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. My guest today is Dr. Lawrence Brown, who has coined a widely adopted phrase that encapsulates racial and spatial segregation in Baltimore. The black butterfly and the white L refer to the fact that, for the most part, black folks in our city live on an east-west axis that resembles butterfly wings, and white folks live in a north-south axis that looks like the letter L. He argues that the result of this segregation amounts to apartheid, which is duplicated in other cities as well, and which is caused by unaddressed historical trauma, hyper-policing, and generations of resource removal, displacement, and wealth extraction from black communities. His new book is called The Black Butterfly: The Harmful Politics of Race and Space in America. Lawrence Brown joins me today on Midday after the news. And good afternoon. Welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're with us. My guest today is the data scientist, scholar, and author Dr. Lawrence Brown. Former member of the Morgan State University faculty, he's also been a visiting professor at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. He teaches in the Johns Hopkins Urban Health Institute's Bunting Neighborhood Leadership Program, and he has spoken and written widely on racial equity and health issues in particular. He has written a provocative book that challenges us to change the frame in which we understand racial equity and what it will take for America to move toward a more just society. Brown chronicles how the long history of land dispossession, the migration of African Americans away from the Jim Crow South, the subsequent displacement from the urban centers in which they settled, and the destabilization of black neighborhoods has led to a segregated economy and ongoing historical trauma that amounts to an American system of apartheid. Dr. Brown makes concrete proposals as to how to dismantle this apartheid and improve outcomes for black Americans in housing, education, policing, and public health. The book is called The Black Butterfly: The Harmful Politics of Race and Space in America. Lawrence Brown joins us from his home in Baltimore. Dr. Brown, welcome.
Good afternoon, Tom.
I'm very glad to have you with us today and delighted to have finally gotten a chance to read this book. It's been out since January, and I was looking forward to it, and I was not disappointed, I'll tell you. There's some really wonderful thinking in here and imaginative ideas. Let me ask you to begin by defining what you mean by the black butterfly and the white L.
Sure, and it's great to be with you. Also want to let folks know I'm actually back at Morgan State working with the new Center for Urban Health Equity. The way I define the black butterfly is a demographic description of where African Americans are clustered in East and West Baltimore. And it's also a description of where capital congregates as well. So it's not just a description of where people live. It's a description of either where capital is accumulating or where capital is deprived. And so in the black butterfly, there's a deprivation of capital that flows into these black neighborhoods.
And right at the top of the book, you make the point that politicians, philanthropists are often seen applauding themselves for doing good work without any clarity concerning what racial equity actually means. You talk about the dangers of counterfeit equity. Talk about what you mean by the term racial equity and what you think everybody else, you know, should mean by it as well.
Well, you know, racial equity really should mean that we're doing more for the communities that have less due to ongoing historical trauma. So when people aren't familiar with ongoing historical trauma, they're not familiar with how racial segregation, forced displacement, economic destruction, physical and psychological violence, like the murder of George Floyd, when people aren't familiar with these elements of historical trauma, there's no way they can address them. And so that's what I mean when I say racial equity is doing more. It's not a conversation. It's not having Dr. Brown give a lecture. It's not, you know, having a conference where people come and talk. It's actually restoration, restoring communities that have been hurt and damaged by those elements of historical trauma that I mentioned.
Yeah, and you write that equity doesn't mean equal when corrective action is the goal. The goal here is action that fixes the longstanding problem, not just acknowledgement of the problem.
Absolutely. You know, in research, we do a lot of, there's a lot of papers, a lot of studies that come out about health disparities or racial disparities. So, you know, there are a lot of those discussions today, you know, disparities in income, disparities in wealth. And those are nice and they help illuminate gaps, but they aren't the same thing as addressing and correcting the harm that caused those gaps. And so I think that's where my emphasis is on in what people are doing, not what they're saying, but what they're doing. And if action isn't being taken to heal, to repair, to correct the damage that was inflicted, then in fact, you're not really talking about racial equity.
You have a list of five things that are required kind of as a prerequisite, a strategy to achieve racial equity. The first is to deeply understand the historical trauma that has been inflicted on Black neighborhoods for generations. What's key to that understanding? What's at the fundamental, what's the fundamental element of an understanding of historical trauma? This is something you come back to repeatedly in the book.
Well, the first thing is sort of, I look at it's an analogy to surgery. If you're going to conduct surgery, you just can't come in having a generalized understanding of the human body. You have to understand anatomy, physiology, how the knee bone is connected to the leg bone. You have to understand nervous system. You have to understand the immune system, the endocrine system. You have to have a very razor sharp knowledge of how the human body operates before you can conduct surgery on a patient. And I think the analogy is the same for society. If we're going to conduct surgery on society to help induce healing, then you can't do that if you don't know policies, practices, systems, and budgets that help cause harm. So if you're not familiar with racial zoning, racially restrictive covenants, redlining, subpriming, marginalizing, demonizing communities, you know, if you're not familiar with Plessy versus Ferguson, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, if you're not familiar with the ways by which Black communities are deprived of resources, then there's no way you can conduct the type of surgical actions that are needed to help heal those communities. So really that deep understanding consists of being able to say more than just institutional racism or just giving a description of structural oppression, but actually being very concrete and being able to know what happened, when it happened, how it happened, so that you can undo the damage in very specific and particular ways.
Dr. Lawrence Brown is my guest here on Midday. I'm Tom Hall. We're talking about his book, The Black Butterfly, The Harmful Politics of Race and Space in America. We'll take calls and comments a little bit later here on Midday. And Dr. Brown, you talk about the importance of making decisions in these redline communities, in these communities that have experienced these this generational flow of historical trauma, the importance of making decision-making participatory and deeply democratic. Having the people in the communities come up with solutions and strategies and ways forward. And that's another thing that hasn't happened in many cases, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the big things that I talk about in the book is really, first of all, my unit of analysis is Black neighborhoods. I'm very much interested in what's happening at the neighborhood level, particularly in hyper-segregated cities. So Baltimore, like a hurricane, is a Category 5 hyper-segregated city. So Category 5, the most intense, the most damaging form of racial segregation that we have. And what I try to get across in my book is the fact that the damage of segregation is not just the deprivation of capital, it's also locking people out of decision-making about what happens in their community. And so therefore, to heal the damage of hypersegregation, you actually have to make sure decision-making is participatory, is democratic, because once again, people have been locked out of being able to have a say in what happens in their community. So that's a part of the healing process as well.
And do you find that when that democratic approach to, determining strategies and determining ways forward is employed, that there are generational differences, that there are differing perspectives, and that consensus even within the neighborhoods, within the communities? I know I go to my neighborhood association meetings in Reservoir Hill, and it's rarely the case where we have real consensus and everybody nods their head in agreement that we should do X, Y, or Z. It's not without problems, is it?
Oh, absolutely. Democracy is messy.
Because
you're going to have people's voices and people's thoughts and people's ideas. And that's okay. That's actually what democracy should do. The problem has been is that with urban apartheid, we've locked out African-American neighborhoods, redlined neighborhoods, from being involved in decision-making processes. So you've had everything from racial zoning to racially restrictive covenants, urban renewal, which uprooted over 25,000 people in Baltimore between the 50s and the mid 70s, highways being built through Black communities. So all of these decisions, have been made, public housing being placed in Black communities, and then also along the waterfront near the harbor. You've had Black communities that haven't had a say in terms of how their communities are going to be developed. And so now part of the restoration is, how do we make Black neighborhoods matter? How do we allow people in Black redlined communities to make decisions to say, here's how we want to be developed. Here's the housing that we want. Here are the schools that we need. Here's the infrastructure that's going to help us get to where we need to go. That is what has to happen because urban apartheid has been inflicted in Black neighborhoods for 110 years in Baltimore City.
And you write that urban apartheid was erected with white supremacist terrorism, with segregation, with land dispossession, exploitative labor arrangements, racial cleansing. You list the other cities that you identify as apartheid cities, not just Baltimore, Chicago, Detroit, Flint, St. Louis, Cleveland, Birmingham, Milwaukee, Philly, and a few others. You talk about a reckoning is required to assess the costs of this apartheid so that a restorative strategy can be, developed and employed. What's the process? How does one make that assessment? How does one come to that reckoning of the costs of urban apartheid?
That's a great question. That's something that is really not something that an individual would do. It's really something that at the municipal level, cities, city government, agencies, departments, and also other institutions, you might include in Baltimore, the Greater Baltimore Committee. You might include the Baltimore Development Corporation. Certainly our premier prestigious educational institutions like a Johns Hopkins. Each of these institutions and governing agencies, philanthropy, big philanthropy in our city, really needs to undergo an analysis of how each of these institutions and entities have actually played a role, again, through policies, practices, systems, and budgets. And so that's the formula right there. The review has to be systemic. A reckoning means really an accounting. So you have to count how many policies did the city of Baltimore put in place? And Baltimore is really ground zero for urban apartheid. Baltimore City, because you had Mayor John Barry Mahool, he passed the first residential racial zoning law December 19th, 1910. So Baltimore jumps to the head of the pack in terms of cities in America and says, this is how you do it. And then it's exported to St. Louis. It's exported to Atlanta. The next Baltimore mayor, James Preston, he's in the newspapers. He's telling other cities, you should try it. We've done it. So a reckoning is having an understanding of how we did it, who did it, and how it was done. How much did it cost? How much damage did it inflict? And I think that's the type of reckoning that, again, is very specific, very concrete, not loosey-goosey, but again, policies, practices, systems, and budgets.
Yeah, I mean, definitely the argument can be made that Baltimore literally wrote the book on redlining and covenants and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe because we were the ones that kind of invented it, we could be the first to dismantle it. Dr. Lawrence Brown, the book is called The Black Butterfly, The Harmful Politics of Race and Space in America. We'll have more with Dr. Brown on the other side of a quick break, and we will take your calls and comments here on Midday. Our number, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. To tweet us, it's @MiddayWYPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're tuned to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, a trip to the lighter side for more than a decade. Harold and Shirley Koblenur collected sayings and expressions that they heard in conversations and in various media. They compiled these sayings into a book that includes thousands of expressions, and tomorrow their daughter, Beth, joins me to play some of those games for word nerds and lovers of linguistics. So whether you're over the moon or under the weather, on top of the world, or in over your head, join us to have some fun with, so to speak, 11,000 expressions that'll knock your socks off. That's coming up tomorrow. If you've just joined us today, my guest is Dr. Lawrence Brown. We're talking about his book published in January called The Black Butterfly, The Harmful Politics of Race and Space in America. To join our conversation, we're at 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. So, Dr. Brown, when it comes to the role of the black elite, particularly political elite. I mean, here in Baltimore, we have had, you know, African-American politicians, you know, in high office and mayor, and state's attorney, city council president for a while. You write that, you know, questions need to be raised about the black elite and whose side they are on. And I wonder, how do we get on the same side? How does the city come together racially, or what is the role of coming together racially? Is it a matter of coming together, or is it a matter of you know, the white community and the white power structure, you know, allowing black neighborhoods and black leaders to do their own thing?
Well, I'm going to address the first question first. So the black political elite, the issue there is that campaign financing means that whoever is contributing to any politician's campaign, they can often either, you know, set up some sort of quid pro quo arrangement. You know, they're going to be coming back to that politician's office once they're elected, and they're going to looking for a return on their donation, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so the problem becomes when most of the donations, when most of the financing is coming from corporations, particularly large white dominated organizations in the city, then the prerogatives, the policies, the practices that are put forth are often meant to service those corporations and not the people living in redlined black communities. And so I think that's the thing. We have this sort of corporate capture where corporate prerogatives are put forward and then issues impacting black communities, redlined communities, are placed on the back seat. So that's the fundamental issue that I think we see. And so basically that results in a situation where the hyper-segregation that impacts redlined black communities has not been addressed, even though we've had black political leadership. And I just want to offer a quick definition or quick understanding that the damage of hyper-segregation is the hyper-aggregation of capital in white communities and the hyper-deprivation of capital in black communities. So it's not just white and black people living apart from each other. It's the way that capital flows or doesn't flow into one community or another. And that's the dynamic that has not been addressed.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point that you make in this book and you've just made here. The issue of resource removal, wealth extraction from redlined Black communities. Talk about how that has taken place over the generations. Talk about, you know, some examples of where that's happened in Black communities as a result of redlining or in conjunction with redlining.
Sure. Well, redlining really is a term that was created on a map called the residential security map. If you read Antero Patella's book, Not in My Neighborhood, he has a great chapter on there called Mapping Bigotry. So he outlines how the federal government uses the pseudoscience of eugenics, so this race-based notion about who's intelligent, who's worthy, who is, you know, capable. It uses that to sort of color code communities in urban areas, four different colors, green, blue, yellow, and red. And it's based on this sort of racial hierarchy. So that those maps, which were drawn by the federal government in the 1930s, those maps systemically deprived capital in Black neighborhoods. So that's the primary example. But you also see examples like today, you have the National Community Reinvestment Coalition. They've done, and other people have done, research showing how redlining is still going on in Baltimore and other cities. And then you also, that's the private side of wealth denial, of capital deprivation. But even there's been public studies. Our delegate, Stephanie Smith, who's, I believe, working in the office, the budget office, she did a study a few years back looking at capital budget spending by the city of Baltimore. And she found that in communities that are predominantly of color, they have roughly half the allocation of the public capital budget compared to communities that are predominantly white. So I argue that redlining is actually both private and public. So it's happening in multiple ways through multiple budgets.
And is the answer to redlining getting rid of the lines or improving those neighborhoods that, you know, have existed now for a long time within those lines? Is breaking the lines and just, you know, abolishing the lines going to be a more feasible, viable strategy than building up and elevating those people who are living within these lines that have been here for a long time?
Well, that's a great question. I think really the question you're asking is the question of desegregation. Mm-hmm. How do we effectuate desegregation in urban areas that have been hyper-segregated? And I, you know, the 1968 Fair Housing Act was the first step to begin any sort of thinking around how do we actually prevent housing discrimination, and then how do we actually allow people to live where they want to live, fair housing, open housing. So I think it's both and. I think housing mobility, it should be on the table. Black people should not be confined to neighborhoods that don't have resources. I mean, in fact, when we think about desegregation, the issue is not Black people being able to move to where white people live, as if somehow that's going to automatically make Black people successful. Black people can be successful in Black neighborhoods. The issue is white neighborhoods have the resources. So housing mobility to those neighborhoods should definitely be an option, but it should not be the only option. White neighborhoods shouldn't be the only neighborhoods that have resources. Everybody doesn't want to move to a white neighborhood in Black communities. So I think the idea that we have to have is both and. Let's have desegregation that happens through housing mobility and by making Black neighborhoods matter. Yeah. So I think both need to be on the table.
Yeah, it's a really important point, and you write about, and you've mentioned it, you know, we hear a lot about white flight in the 70s and the 80s. The Black population in our city between 1990 and 2016 is down close to 50,000 people.
Right.
It's a lot of folks. And, you know, where are they going? Why are they leaving? So, yeah, it's not just a matter of having folks move across town to a different neighborhood. Because if too many people do that, then those neighborhoods that are left are decimated. They don't have, you know, investment and energized people living there. It's a real complicated thing. We have a caller, Donna, who's on the line from Baltimore. Donna, welcome to the program with Dr. Lawrence Brown.
Yeah, how you doing? And wonderful show, and great to hear your call, your speaker, Dr. Brown. Dr. Brown, and I have when I hear you call on different talk shows, I have a long background in land use planning. I graduated from Morgan. My great grandmother, my great aunt, graduated from Morgan in 1910, and I have a long history of African-American women and men who had successful businesses in this black butterfly you keep talking about. We were not the black elite. They were not the black. They were just working-class African-Americans. My great-grandmother and grandmother moved in these areas in the 40s and 50s when it was still segregated. Mm-hmm. These communities had a flowing class of working-class teachers, doctors, and lawyers who are African-American. I never hear you talk about the working class blacks who flourished in these communities. The communities, what you're seeing now, were not what it looked like then. Mm-hmm. I don't hear you talk about how you interviewed the descendants of the people who lived in these communities, like myself, grandchildren, nieces, whatever, because we grew up in these communities were flourishing. What you see now is not what it was then.
Right.
Corner stores, bakeries. My grandfather had a bakery. They had meat shops. They had cleaners, the Dinkins cleaners. They're still there. Walbrook Johnson Junction, Mondawmin, Druid Hill Park, all these places were flourishing communities. It's when the industry, when the Bethlehem Steel, because a lot of people were moving up south, people were bringing their cousins and families, and we even saw the neighborhoods change when, you know, some families had 20 people live in one home because a lot of people were coming up to get work in the steel mills. When the steel mills closed down is when everything changed.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for that call, Don. I appreciate it. And Dr. Brown, you know, that was 50 or 60 years ago, and a lot has happened in, you know, certainly the 30 or 40 years since, you know, the decimation of manufacturing, and the population of the city is down. I mean, as a whole, it's down some 400,000 people since then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and that's a great point that your caller made. And I do address that in my book. And what I discuss is how black neighborhoods, I agree with her, black neighborhoods were actually stronger. It's paradoxical. Black neighborhoods were stronger under segregation, but not because of segregation. What made black neighborhoods stronger then was that they were on some level allowed to be intact. They didn't undergo the type of uprooting that they would begin to experience going forward, particularly, well, depending on where you start. We're just getting ready, for instance, to come up on the 100th anniversary or the 100th commemoration of the destruction of Black Greenwood in Tulsa. And that was a thriving Black community destroyed by white supremacist violence. In Baltimore, thriving Black community, but it was destroyed, highways being built through West Baltimore, urban renewal, uprooting many Black people, but also Black businesses, jazz clubs, churches, you know, Black institutions. So I absolutely agree with the caller. And the way that I discuss that in my book is that the area where I talk about Black neighborhood destruction, that paradoxically Black neighborhoods were stronger when they didn't undergo so many instances of being uprooted and so many Black people being displaced, that activity, when it happened progressively over and over again, that's really what destroyed Black communities. And so I think that's where I do attempt to deal with that question. And hopefully in future works, I will actually address some of those other questions she raised as well.
Yeah, and I think of North Avenue, for example, where the expressway 83 just plows yep. right through it. And at that juncture where the entrance to 83 is now, just to the west of that is this place called Madison North, which has been, you know, a pile of dirt for 15 years or something. I mean, a long time. There were some housing projects there that were, you know, rife with violence and drug dealing, and people were very upset about it. I mean, I live over there, so I've lived there for 35 years, so I'm well aware of the neighborhood opposition to that thing. Everybody seemed very excited about redeveloping Madison North. But nothing's happened since. I mean, there's stuff on the planning, you know, on the boards to be planned, but it hasn't happened. But you talk about Park Heights Renaissance. You talk about even neighborhoods like Station North or Greenmount West, McKeldry Park, you know, places. And it brings up this notion of gentrification and the dangers of that and the difficulties of that. Talk about the tension between when neighborhoods get gentrified, when things, you know, where a higher quality of services and retail and housing is put in, but then the prices go up and it displaces or can displace legacy people who've lived there. How does one balance those two opposing poles?
Right, and your question goes to the caller's question, that this idea that the only way we can save working class black communities is to gentrify them, which results in displacing the people who live there. So the only way to save these communities is to get rid of the people who live in those places. And so that's the very thing that I'm trying to argue in my book, is that the solution that we haven't tried is actually allocating resources to those communities so that people, when they have development, it occurs without displacement. And how do we do that? That's a policy prescription that we haven't tried. We've tried housing mobility, and that's great. And we've tried gentrification, which is not great. What we haven't tried is allocating resources so that people can stay where they are and not be racked by the deprivation that happens when you have redlining. So that's the thing, the sweet middle spot that I'm looking for.
And talk more about that sweet middle spot, because that's something that I have for a long time had a tough time getting my silly white head around, I guess. And that, you know, how does one allocate resources without gentrifying the place, the neighborhood? I mean, how does one improve it or make it better for those who are there without sort of automatically making it more attractive to other people who maybe come to the table at a higher income level than the people who've been there historically?
Well, the first thing I think to realize about gentrification, and I talk about this at length in my book, is that gentrification is not just a private, you know, prescription. It's not just banks and people coming in with money. It's also a public. The public sector is also very heavily involved. In fact, gentrification is often subsidized. In Baltimore, the subsidy, one major subsidy, is called Live Near Your Work. So that's inviting employers to bring in employees who don't live in that community near their institution or corporation to come and live in the city. So you're basically giving people a gentrification subsidy, right? So my thing is, and I talk about this in the book, we should have a stay where you are voucher, so that if you have lived in that community, if the people from outside are getting $3,500, which you can get up to that if you're an employee living very close to Johns Hopkins, if they can get a $35,000 grant, then the people that live there should get a $45,000-$50,000 grant. They should have more of an incentive, more resourcing, so that when that development comes, they have the resources to, you know, spruce up their homes, fix up their houses, you know, that so that you can have a good looking community, because that's what that influx of capital is going to do. It's going to bring in new buildings, new infrastructure. Great. So everybody should be able to benefit from that. And the people that are there also freeze their taxes, the existing residents, so that, you know, as taxes go up, they're not having to pay more taxes. But I think there's, you know, there are different things you can do so that working class black people, when that money comes, they're not being pushed out. Stay where you are voucher, freeze their taxes. and whatever, and, you know, making sure people have ownership of their homes so that, you know, folks can't just come in and buy them out.
Now, you make a really compelling argument about it's a three-pronged stool here. It begins with, you know, the culmination of a public policy, meaning redlining, in the beginning. And then oftentimes there's government-financed demolition in the middle, you know, when blight takes over. And then you've got government subsidies to incentivize various people at the end. So that is, you know, it's just a very different, you're talking about a different frame, about a different way of taking a look at it. And I think it's really, really imaginative and fascinating. We're going to take a break. We'll come back and talk more about it. Lawrence Brown is the author of The Black Butterfly, The Harmful Politics of Race and Space in America. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stick around.
You're listening to your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest is Dr. Lawrence Brown. He has coined the phrase the black butterfly and the white L to describe the racial and spatial and resource divide here in Baltimore. We're talking about his new book. It's a treatise in 8 tracks in which he chronicles the effects of historical trauma experienced by African Americans, and he offers suggestions for achieving lasting equity. The book is called The Black Butterfly, The Harmful Politics of Race and Space in America. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. You can tweet us as well. So, Dr. Brown, you mentioned when it comes to housing equity, you talked about the state where you are, housing voucher. You also talk about reinvigorating public housing. We have a caller on the line, Janet, who wants to talk about that. Janet, welcome to Midday with Dr. Lawrence Brown.
Oh, thank you. And I'm glad to talk to both of you. Dr. Brown, what would you suggest we do with public housing where we have poor people and some working class people congregated in one area, that unit or that particular public housing either gets, they just neglect them, whoever is managing them. And that causes a lot of hard feelings when people recognize they might have to live around people that have Section 8, and I'm not saying that's bad. But what would you do with the old 60s approach, which I think was a terrible idea, where we have congregated poor people and public housing has caused a problem? I'd just love to hear what you have to say about that. Thank you.
Yes. Well, you bring up an excellent point, which I also try to address in the book, called this term concentrated poverty that many people use. And they don't say who concentrated the poverty or how the poverty was concentrated. And I think that's what the caller is really alluding to, is that you had the federal government, along with local public housing authorities, they intentionally placed public housing developments in those red line black communities. You don't see public housing in Roland Park, in Guilford, in Homeland, in Mount Washington, in Lorville, in Towson, in the Baltimore County area. You don't see that because public housing was put intentionally in red line black communities. So I think that's the first thing we recognize whenever we have conversations about public housing, is that this was government policy. You can read also Richard Rothstein's great book, The Color of Law. He delves into that even more. But when you have this sort of policy regime that concentrates people in poverty in these redline black communities, again, and then they, well, as I said earlier, these communities are redlined, so they don't get capital. They're subprime. Whenever the capital does come, it's offered in an exploitative way, high interest rates. So this dynamic, it creates the situation that you described, the hard feelings, it creates the crime and violence as well in these communities, because people don't have resources to survive. And when people don't have resources to survive, they're going to fight and struggle to make a way out of no way. So that's the issue that we have here. So public housing, I mean, is the way we've, you know, America has sort of demolished so many public housing units, starting with Hope 6 in the 90s under Clinton, you know, demolished like a quarter of the public housing units. What we've had in America is this retrenchment. We're getting rid of public goods, particularly in Black neighborhoods. We're tearing down schools. We're tearing down public housing. We're tearing down public rec centers. So, and then we're asking communities to survive without these resources. So for me, public housing is really part of a larger landscape of how do we ensure that redlined Black neighborhoods have the resources they need to survive. And I think that's where we have to do more public housing, more public rec centers, more spending on our schools so that these communities have what they need. Because again, redlining meant the intentional deprivation of capital and the intentional placement of poor people in those communities. So we're going to have to do a lot of work to allocate resources. I don't like that word invest, because now you're looking for ROI. Public goods are not about ROI, return on investment. They are about what people need to thrive. And that's where I think you definitely see my concern about the working class, like a caller mentioned earlier. This is specifically about making sure that working class, lower income people have what they need to thrive and survive.
When I talked to Dr. Santelises, the superintendent of Baltimore City Public Schools, she is wrestling with a decrease in the number of students. And, you know, this real estate that she owns or that the school system owns, because there's so many buildings that are being underutilized. You have an excellent suggestion, and this is in light of the Kerwin Commission recommendations that the legislature has been, you know, fooling with for the last couple of years, about per school funding formula as opposed to per pupil funding formula. And I assume that part of the animation behind that idea is to keep those schools in those communities because schools are such an anchor for those places.
Absolutely. I mean, if you close a school, a public school in a Black community, you're not only closing a school, you're closing an after-school site, a community center, a polling site for voting, you know, a pantry for food. It functions in a different way, you know, an employment site for oftentimes historically Black teachers. So again, we're taking those resources away when we close down public schools. And now you're talking about the problem of the building surplus, these empty buildings now because they've been closed. And so now that they're closed, yes, how could we use them? How could communities use them as a space for community gardening, as a space for community centers? You know, there should be no empty building that's just sitting there not being of use to a community, because that's a public good that was once in use as a school, you know, but now it's just many of them are empty buildings. Of course, they need to be renovated in many instances, but, you know, that's a question for sure, you know, at this juncture.
Ray is on the line. Ray, you've been very patient, calling from Midtown Edmondson. Thanks so much. You're on the line with Dr. Lawrence Brown.
Yeah, hi. Good afternoon. I'm calling because when you mentioned these things about redlining and these neighborhoods that are associated or within the Black butterfly, but when you have an anchor like the Baltimore Mark, West Baltimore Mark Station, and now the Link Bus Depot, that's not properly purposed. Do you think that's done through the indifference of race?
Well, I mean, now you're mentioning another system, you know, DOT, Department of Transportation, you know, the state Maryland Department of Transportation. There's transit apartheid. We don't have an east-west rail line, light rail that goes through the city. We have that MARC rail that kind of runs down heading to D.C. as opposed to giving us a true east-west access through the butterfly for those communities in particular. So, yes, transportation is another system that replicates urban apartheid. So you have transit systems that don't serve Black neighborhoods. You have parks and recs, you know, that don't serve Black housing and community development. System after system that is either redlining or ignoring, not providing what is needed so that Black neighborhoods have equity and have real healing and restoration from years and decades of disinvestment and of inflicting all kinds of economic apartheid on these communities. So yes, to your question, and yes, for many other systems that are also doing the same thing.
We have a tweet from somebody who's unknown who says, what neighborhoods in Baltimore are making steps in the right direction, getting investment, desegregating, in your opinion, Dr. Brown?
You know, that's a great question. You know, I can't think of any off the spot because this is not something a single neighborhood could do on their own. This was, remember, Baltimore Mayor John Barry Mahool. He passed the first residential racial zoning law in American history. Baltimore Mayor James Preston and the city councils, they're assisting these mayors in passing these policies. You know, he uproots Black people across from Mercy Hospital in a community that was called Gallows Hill in 1917. Plus, he reinforces through various ordinances, you know, racial segregation in the city. So this is something that the city officials have to fix. This is urban apartheid is a matter of the mayor, of the city council, of city departments and agencies, of philanthropies and corporations, all looking in the mirror and looking at their history, their role in perpetuating and inflicting urban apartheid. That's the challenge. And so this is not something that Edmondson or Greenmount East or even Roland Park or different community cross country can fix on their own. Now, I would say that those white neighborhoods, white L neighborhoods, the Roland Park, Mount Washington, Guilford, Homeland, Hamden, Lorville, which is mixed but was predominantly white in the past, that those communities do have an obligation, because I show in my book how their neighborhood associations lobbied the city for racial segregation. They pushed the mayors of those times, say, hey, we want racial segregation. So I don't see any of those communities stepping up saying, and now we're going to play a role in fixing it.
Yeah,
now we're going to help fix the damage we caused.
You talk about how back in the day, Morgan College, the predecessor of Morgan State University, had a plan to move to Mount Washington, and that got nixed pretty quick. You know, they just, the folks just rose up against it, as well as the covenants that, you know, are famously, you know, entrenched in our city. One of the ideas you have, and we just got a couple minutes left here, is for Black-owned resource cooperatives. What are those? How do they work?
So they're cooperatives like worker cooperatives, energy cooperatives, food cooperatives. These are enterprises that would be owned not just by two people that are in a relationship or a solo entrepreneur. These would be entities owned by a group, preferably a community enterprise, so that you could have wealth that's being drawn in. You know, I'm looking particularly right now at the cannabis industry, which just reached $1 billion in sales in the state of Maryland. And very few of those dollars are coming to Black neighborhoods. And we know in Black neighborhoods, many of the people that have been arrested and placed in jail based on marijuana and cannabis offenses, that's where we're talking about repairing. If the damage was done there, the repair has to be done there.
And that's where we have to leave it, unfortunately. Dr. Lawrence Brown, the book is called The Black Butterfly, The Harmful Politics of Race and Space in America. Thank you so much. This has really been a great conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom. Always a pleasure.
That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, we will examine the origins of phrases and expressions that are kind of part of our colloquial landscape and how they came to find their place there. Beth Kobliner joins me to have fun with the new book, So to Speak, 11,000 Expressions That'll Knock Your Socks Off. That's coming up tomorrow. Coming up now, it's Here and Now. Don't forget to download The Daily Dose. That's WIPR's compendium of local stories put together by our WIPR news team. You could also check out the Chesapeake Connect podcast. I host those conversations about the importance of regionalism here in the Baltimore metro area. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Midday. I appreciate it. Have a great day.
You're listening to your NPR News station. Member supported 88.1 WYPR.